Hi everyone, thank you for having me. Today I want to talk to you about this work we've been doing on the Kanon proposal, and in particular its application to 1+1 dimensional gravity. So here's short kind of presentation of what I'm going to talk about. I'm first going to give you an introduction of just in general why we are so interested in symmetries, because the Kanon proposal is all about symmetries, as we're going to see, and also kind of give you a motivation of why we want to look at corners, which I'm going to talk about them more, but are co-dimension two surfaces that you can think of as the boundary of the spatial slice. Then I'm going to talk about symmetries, in particular in gauge theories, because that's what we're interested about, especially in gravity. Then with the tools that I introduced in this section, I can finally give you kind of the main idea of the Kanon proposal, and then we can move to its application to 1+1 dimensional gravity. Right, so as a motivation, why are we so interested in symmetries? Well, as you know, symmetries are very important in all of physics. For example, it's a great tool to find solutions. For example, cosmology hinges on just the symmetries of the problem that allows you to solve Einstein's equation. But more to the point of this talk, they also are used to describe fundamental interaction through gauge theories in the standard model. That's the standard model gauge group here. And even more to the point, they actually can be thought of as the defining properties of our most fundamental theories, quantum field theories based on the Poincaré symmetry. And I'm going to talk about this a bit more later, what I mean by defining property. And then obviously relativity, general relativity and gravity is based on diffeomorphism invariance. So symmetries are present in all of physics, and in particular, very important in theoretical and fundamental physics. Now, as I said before, the corners are the boundaries of the spatial slice, so the spatial boundary that co-dimensioned two surfaces. And it has been known for a while now that the very interesting physics happens in gauge theories when boundaries are present. Maybe one of the first examples of that is the quantum Hall effect in condensed matter physics. But more recently, holography and black hole physics is also obviously based on boundary physics. And in particular, gravity, which is going to be the interest today, can be thought of as a gauge theory of diffeomorphisms. And so we expect something to happen at the spatial boundaries in gravity. And it happens that on the boundary, there exists a symmetry group or algebra called the Kanon symmetry group. And the idea of the Kanon proposal is to say that this symmetry group is actually the fundamental ingredient of gravity. And I'm going to talk more about that later. This is just a short introduction. So that's kind of the main setting that we're into. Now let me talk about symmetries and then what happens in gauge theory symmetries. So as I've said before, this is just kind of further motivation. Symmetries are very important. So for example, from the Poincaré algebra that I just put here, this is the Poincaré algebra, there's two things you can do that are very interesting. First of all, you can consider the coadjoint orbits of this algebra, so what you do is you take the co-algebra and you look at the orbits of the action of the group on its own co-algebra, and those orbits are symplectic manifolds, so you can take them as phase space. And once you do all that with the Poincaré group, you actually find everything you need to have. You can define the action, you can define the phase space of the kinematics, but also the action, the dynamics of the classical relativistic particles, so the spinning massive particles. And on the quantum side of things, if you look at the unitary irreducible representations of this group, it gives you all of the Hilbert spaces of particles, right? So you have representations are labeled by the Casimir, which is the mass and the spin in the case of the Poincaré group, and then all of the representations with definite mass and spin gives you the Hilbert space of that particle in quantum field theory, right? So this is why we're so interested in symmetries, because from only the symmetry algebra, which is kind of a very simple mathematical structure when you think about it, you can get everything you need about the classical theory, and you can get at least the kinematics of the quantum theory, so the Hilbert space. So the idea is that we want to do that, but with gravity, okay? So the gravity is going to be a bit more complicated because gravity has gauge symmetries, obviously. So we're going to get to that, but first, the tool that we are going to use to describe symmetries in gravity is symplectic geometry, in particular the The formalism we use is the covariant phase-space formalism that I'm not going to go into any details because I don't have time, but just let me give you the main ideas. If you have a field theory with the Lagrangian, you can get a symplectic structure by taking the variation of the Lagrangian, and then you're going to have the equation of motions, and you're going to have, as usual, with when you vary the Lagrangian, you integrate by part, right? And then you have all of these terms that you get total derivatives from integrating by parts. You put them in this boundary term here, this total derivative boundary terms here. And this is actually what gives you the symplectic structure. So what you can do with this boundary term here, theta, you can then take his variation, this delta, this kind of field space derivative, then integrate it on a spatial slice. Sigma is, think of it as a Cauchy slice. And you get a two form on field space, right? Not on space time. You get a field space two form that is closed. And it's not necessarily non-degenerate, as you know, for symplectic, as you may know, for symplectic geometry, you need a closed two form that is also non-degenerate. At this point, it might not be non-degenerate, and that is because of gauge symmetry. So that's what we're going to talk a bit more about. But that's how you get the symplectic structure. And then what can you do with this symplectic structure? Well, if you have a symmetry that you represent as a vector field on field space, so think of a vector field that pushes you along field space in the direction of a symmetry of the theory, you can take the contraction of this form with this field space vector, and this will give you the differential of the charge. And this is nothing really new. This is just Hamilton's equation in the symplectic language. And this is just a picture that I took yesterday, just downstairs. So it's a very illegal tag to show you that people know about this equation. It's obviously very known. The only difference is that it's on field space, right? So everything is on field space, where this equation is more the normal one that you use in classical mechanics. So you get this charge here from the symplectic structure, and then this charge is going to be given as we expect, as we know, as the integral of a current over the Cauchy slice. Right? So this is kind of just rehashing what everyone knows about Noether theorem, except now we're working at the level of field space already. And you have this charge. Now, what's really interesting about gauge symmetries is that if you take a vector on field space that generates a gauge symmetry, what happens is that you actually get that the current, this G, is a total differential. It's a total differential here. So then by Stokes theorem, integration, Stokes theorem in just fundamental theorem of calculus, if you've never heard of Stokes theorem, this charge isn't going to be pulled back on the boundary, right? So on the boundary here of the spatial slice, and you have that the gauge charge is only supported on the boundary. And this is what's weird about gauge theories and their interaction with corners. So this boundary here, boundary of the spatial slice, that's the corner, okay? That's what I mean by corner. So that's what happens with gauge symmetry. So what does that mean? Well, the first thing it means is that if you don't have any spatial boundaries, the gauge charge is just going to be zero, right? So contraction gives zero. And that is actually this is kind of a reflection of what we mean when we say that gauge symmetries are not physical. They're not physical because they don't have an associated charge to them. So that is the statement when there's no boundary. The gauge symmetries are just normal gauge symmetries. And then what you can do is that you say, and you see also here that this symplectic form is degenerate then, right? There's direction of the symplectic form that are null directions, so it's degenerate. And then what you can do with that is that you say, okay, the vectors that kill the symplectic form are actually the gauge direction, and then you quotient them out of your phase space, that's symplectic reduction, gauge reduction, to get the physical phase space on which the symplectic form is going to be non-degenerate, and then you have a real symplectic form. So what's happened with no boundaries? But we saw if there is a boundary, a spatial boundary, what happens is that you have an unvanishing charge. So what you can do is just a quick comment about what we call edge modes. What you can do is that you can introduce a new field on your field space that only lives on the boundary and takes value in the group, the symmetry group of your theory. And then to this new field, you can associate a symplectic structure that when you add it to the original symplectic structure, you get this vanishing of the contraction the gauge symmetry as we did when there were no boundaries present. And so you can use kind of these edge modes to restore gauge invariance even in the presence of boundaries. And this is something you can do with these edge modes that are then fields living on this boundary. And so I went really quickly through all that, but yeah, so then the edge mode kind of eats up the charge and restores gauge symmetry, that's what I've been saying. So if you want more details, so let me give you like a concrete example, and I'm going to take the case of Einstein-Hilbert gravity because that's what we're going to be interested about, but maybe to make all of this a bit more concrete, in Einstein-Hilbert gravity, your field space is just a space of all metrics, and then the symmetries, the gauge symmetries are diffeomorphisms. So if you, the vector that you can take a diffeomorphism that's represented by a vector on the manifold, and you can calculate using all of this machinery of a covariant phase space, you can calculate the charge associated to these diffeomorphisms, and you get this value for the charge here. As you see, as we expected for gauge symmetry, the charge is only supported on the boundary here, right? And this is obviously non-zero for some diffeomorphism. You can find diffeomorphism for which it's non-zero. And what you can do, this edge mode business, is that you can also consider this extended field space here. We have the metric, but also the edge modes that lives on the boundary, such that this charge then becomes zero again. And you can, again, treat these diffeomorphisms as pure gauge symmetries, even in the presence of boundaries. OK, so that's kind of the idea here. And as I was saying, this is all very fast. I know that. So if you want more details, this review paper that we wrote last year, that the idea of it was to talk about all of these edge modes, covariant phase space business in gauge theories in an accessible mathematical language. So that is what we did here. And this is what I will refer to if you want more details on that. OK, so.
Yeah, can I ask something? So
please, yes.
In real life, I mean, including in gravity, of course, the way the diffeomorphisms act is not regular everywhere, right? So it can be phrased in various ways to say, you know, for instance, if I have a G-mu with special symmetries, then the orbit of the diffeomorphism will have a different size from, you know, what it has everywhere else. So these are, of course, subtleties that are, you know, in a very superficial treatment, they're swept under the carpet, but they probably have edge, you know, some analogs when you look at now the edge story. Is that correct? That you need to make assumptions about the, you know, the action of the gauge group.
So
regularity assumptions typically in order for things to work out.
Right. So in the case, so obviously I went very fast and I did not go into the details, but in this paper, for example, if you consider those diffeomorphisms in gravity, you have subtleties. Maybe that's what you're talking about. But for example, you can have fluxes associated to diffeomorphisms that then you can kill those fluxes by considering a subset of diffeomorphisms and that kind of things. But there's actually also a formalism that's called the extended phase space, where you can also take care of these fluxes. So in that whole formalism, you can actually consider completely general diffeomorphisms.
I'm not sure whether the fluxes come into it, but I mean, just the, you know, if you look at the quotient space of the space of all metrics, modular
diffeomorphisms, sure.
That's not a very nice space. It is only a reasonably nice space if you, you know, look at generic points G mu nu. So if you take out things that have, you know, lower dimensional orbits, etc.
Right, so like performing all this symplectic reduction in the case of gravity. So yeah, that's not, I mean, it's a very subtle story, of course. But in this, what I'm trying to give here is just like a general idea of the thing, and then what I'm going to talk about is a different aspect of it. But sure.
I'm not sure, she's talking about the gauge reduction, but you're talking about symmetry, so this is different.
Yes, but
symmetry, you don't quotient.
But you want to question the gauge directions, right?
Yeah.
To get the physical phase space.
Yeah, but what you're focusing on is.
Yeah, but also if you consider the edge modes, as you add the edge modes to the metric field space, then you don't need to quotient those. Don't need to take this quotient because. I'm getting confused. What did you?
I mean, I want to make sure you're talking about
maybe this. We're not talking about the same thing. Yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't get the question.
You're talking about gauge invariance, right?
Well, I'm just putting up the issues that, you know, typical actions by whatever you call it, gauge group or diffeomorphism group, they are not regular, and you need to impose some kind of regularity conditions in order for these constructions, whatever you're doing, to go through. Whenever you do a decomposition, or I'm not quite sure what you're doing, but this, I guess, for the edge modes, a similar issue should come up, I imagine.
So, from what I understand with this covariant phase space formalism, I don't think that such issue arises, but maybe we're not trying to do the same things. So that might be why.
Maybe one has to make some regularity assumptions,
maybe,
which are, you know,
like put under the rug. Yeah, that's also very possible.
Okay.
For sure. Right, so maybe we can talk about it later. Thank you. Okay, so let me just give you a recap. Oh, okay, last thing I want to say about this symplectic structure, very important, is that it also gives you a charge, an algebra of the charge, so Poisson algebra on those charges by contracting the symplectic form two times. And then you have that this Poisson algebra of the charges here on the right represents the original symmetry of your problem through kind of this formula here. So the Poisson algebra here is given by the charge of the original Lie bracket of the vectors here, modulo central extension. So that's also something that's going to become very important later, is that this algebra is represent the symmetry algebra that you started with, for example, diffeomorphisms, up to central extensions here. OK. So quick recap of what I said in this section that's important. To every symmetry of the theory, there exists an associated charge. That's just another theorem, as we already know it. But we saw that for gauge symmetries, usually this charge vanish, except in the presence of boundaries. Well, then you have a gauge charge associated to the gauge symmetry that lives on the boundary. And so some of these gauge symmetries can become physical on the corner, on the boundary. And then the last slide was that the sets of all of these charges, they form an algebra that we call corner algebra, because algebra of the charges that only have support on the corner. And this corner algebra is going to be a subalgebra, because some of the gauge symmetries might remain pure gauge, might not have a charge associated to them, even in the presence of boundaries. So this corner algebra is going to be a subalgebra of the original gauge algebra you started with. So that's the main ideas. And now let me move to this corner proposal business with all of what I've said in mind. So the corner proposal can be stated with this sentence, that gravity is described by a set of charges in the algebra at corners. So the idea is that this symmetry algebra that we get at the corners, we take that as the fundamental ingredient of gravity. We say gravity is those charges and the algebra. And just to say a bit maybe concrete here, this is the Einstein-Hilbert case, but what we're going to do is more general, just the Einstein-Hilbert theory. But we have this charge here on the corner, this diffeomorphism charge, and then we have the algebra of these charges up to possible central extensions. So that's the idea. So now the question becomes, what is this algebra? What is this group at the corner in the case of gravity? And it turns out that if you restrict yourself for now to corners that are at finite distance, okay? So a finite distance corner, forgetting about the asymptotic symmetries and stuff, you get this group, this corner group that we call the extended corner symmetry group, where you have here S is the corner. So you have the diffeomorphism of the corner that acts on this SL2R and R2 part. And then you also have a copy of SL2R and R2 for each point of the corner. So this is what we call super translations, for example. And this is the group we end up with in gravity for finite distance corner. So as we've been saying, this extended corner symmetry group is going to be a subset of all of the diffeomorphisms. And some of the rest of the diffeomorphisms are left uncharged. So even in the presence of boundaries, the charge is still zero, so they stay pure gauge symmetries. And something that we should note is that while this is a subset, this is still infinite dimensional in a lot of ways. So this is also kind of the origin of a lot of difficulties. Also, a quick comment. This is the group we're going to be working with because we're going to be interested in finite distance corners. But quick comment is that this corner is actually, the symmetry group is actually a subgroup of this universal corner symmetry that is just, you can see that the difference is you also have the trace of this two-dimensional linear group. And this trace is actually exactly what you gives you this BMS W group at asymptotic. This asymptotic symmetry group is encoded here in the trace that we forget about when we consider a finite distance corner. And this universal corner symmetry group is very interesting because it's something that's completely, the universal comes from the fact that you can get this group only by basically topology consideration on your manifold. So in the physical sense, that would mean only from kinematics, and you don't even need dynamics. So it is completely universal, it doesn't depend on dynamics. And then different theories, different boundary conditions, and that kind of stuff will give you different subsets of this universal corner group. So now, let me restate the corner proposal with these groups in mind for more concreteness. The idea is that those symmetry groups, as exactly like the Poincaré group is the fundamental ingredient of quantum field theory, for example, the idea is that those symmetry groups are the fundamental ingredients of gravity. So then you can try to take the coadjoint orbits of this group and try to find the classical theory associated with them. And what we're going to do, you can try to find the universal irreducible representations of this symmetry group, and that will give you the quantum Hilbert space of gravity. Now, why is that not the end of the story? Everything is done and voila. Because finding, you know, finding unitary irreducible representation of infinite dimensional groups is very complicated, and we don't really know how to do it. So there is a difficulty here. Okay, but yeah, again, for I've went through this quite quickly. So if you want more details, there are those papers that the first one, the notes that Luca wrote, which is really well done, and then the second one that we wrote also with Luca and other students about some other lecture notes. And in this, you can find way more details about this whole corner proposal things. Okay, so
sorry, the capital S. On the previous slide was what?
Sorry, again?
On the previous slide, the capital S denoted for.
Where is the capital S?
Everywhere.
The sphere?
Sorry, it's the corner. It's the corner.
It is the corner itself.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's whatever. It's a time-like structure?
No, it's the boundary of the sigma Cauchy slice. Right? So if you think, for example, in 2 plus 1.
You don't consider that kind of in time.
No.
No.
Cauchy slice, and then the spatial has a boundary, that's S. Right? S is d sigma.
Okay. And that is a nice, that's smooth by assumption, or?
So that's probably, Luca will know more about that, but I.
Well, the analysis so far was welcome.
It's quite general.
If you want to say something, you would need to. Yes.
Probably I better choose it nice and smooth.
Yes.
It's a sphere.
Just for fun, how much of the setup would change if I wanted to think of like cutting my space time in half and the corner is time like or something like that, or if I change signatures or something?
I've said like Cauchy surface for this sigma thing, but actually you can also do the whole thing. It doesn't need to be a Cauchy surface to define the charges. So. That is more general. Yes. I think it's more intuitive to think of it as a Cauchy.
Sure. There's just one funny example where like radially quantized celestial CFT would kind of chop the space time like.
Yeah, that's actually a discussion I had with the guy. So yeah, you can actually, it's any three-dimensional cut.
Good.
Sure.
Cool. But in 1+1 dimension, it would be a point.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's exactly what we're going to do now. So yeah. So as I said, the issue is that it's infinite dimensional.
No, you just have an SLT.
Yeah. So then if the corner is just a point, there's no diffeomorphisms on it anymore. Mm-hmm. And then the whole group is going to reduce 1+1 dimensional to this one, which is finite dimensional, which we like, because finite dimensional algebra is way easier to work with. So that's the idea. That's why we want to try to do this in 1+1 dimension, because 1+1 dimension, the corner symmetry group is finite dimensional, and we know how to deal with those. So if you go to 1+1, the whole corner thing, diffeomorphism of the corner just vanishes, and you get this five-dimensional algebra here, which is a SL2R cross R2, that is generated by those generator here. So the L's are the part of the SL2R part of the algebra, and then you have two translations. And this is just the structure of the algebra here. And it turns out also that this algebra has one Casimir, which is important because remember in the Poincaré case, we use the Casimir to label the orbits in the classical case and label the representation in the quantum case. So this Casimir is something that's important. This also means that the orbits are going to be four-dimensional, even though the algebra is five-dimensional, which it needs to be because this whole orbit business, the idea is that you have a symplectic manifold on the dual algebra, and symplectic manifold can only be even-dimensional. So that's what's happening here is that you get reduced to four-dimensional, which is even-dimensional. Anyway, so that's the idea. That's the algebra that we want to work with, and those are the generators. Now, remember, the very important point that I said before is that in general, you need to also, if you want to be the more general possible, you need to consider also central extensions. And it turns out that if you do you use the co-cycles and you do all the mathematics to find the central extension of this algebra, there is one, which is already non-trivial. I'm going to comment on that just later. And there's only one, and it turns out that the only thing you can do is extend the commutation of the translations here with this lambda. Well, lambda has to be understood just as a number multiplying the identity, right? That's the central extension. And then you add this operator to your algebra, and now you have a six-dimensional algebra which has this lambda as a new Casimir, which is trivially Casimir because it's just the identity, so it comes with everything. And what we're going to do as well is that since those are translation, if we want to understand them as translation, they have a dimension of energy, so then this lambda naturally will have dimension of energy squared, and this lambda will actually give us the scale of our problem, because up until now, we only had this kind of abstract algebra, we didn't have any way to have a scale in the problem, but now we have kind of this energy scale here, given by lambda. And let me give you a few comments about this central extension. So the example we've been following up until now is this Poincaré case. And it turns out that in Poincaré, you do the same. You also consider all of the possible central extensions. But it turns out that there's no central extension in the Poincaré case. So that's why we kind of forget about it usually. But this is not completely unheard of. Actually, if you do the exact same story but with the Galilean group instead of the Poincaré one, you find that you can extend the Galilean translation, I mean the translation, and the Galilean boost. You can extend them by this term here, this also central extension here, and this will actually give you so again, it's a new Casimir, and this will actually give you the mass of the particles. So if you do the quadrant orbits of the Galilean group, you need to consider the central extension if you want to be able to talk about massive particle, massive non-relativistic particle, right? And again, in this Galilean case as well, you can see that you have energy dimension of the translation, the boost is dimensionless, so the energy on the right is going to be mass energy, which is what you want. And then the last comment I will just make, because I think that this is quite interesting, is that when you see translation not commuting, the first thing you think of, maybe as gravity people, is curvature. But actually, this is not curvature, because if you remember, if you take the commutation of the two translation, you also have a rotation of the indices, right? It's a commutation of the covariant derivative, you have the Riemann tensor that also rotates the indices of the vector on the right. And here on the right, you just have a multiplication by a number. So what this actually is, what this makes us think of, is torsion. This really looks like torsion. And I think this is something very interesting that we should also think about, and we will. So that's just the kind of the comment I wanted to make with that. Okay, so now we have the algebra, we have the central extension taking into account. How do we represent it? And we will work with this oscillator representation. This SL2R part has a very nice ladder form, right? With the S0R plus and minus. So it turns out it can be represented with those creation annihilation operator in that way. And it turns out that you can extend this representation to the corner group only because you consider the central extension, because otherwise the translation commutes and then you can't represent it on that with that in that form. But now that we consider the central extension, you can actually also represent the translation in that way. And so then we have a Fock space with the action of the creation annihilation operator the same as we used to. And this is what we will take as our Hilbert space of the theory, right? So just the kind of this Fock space of number states that you can go up and down with those creation annihilation operators. And also a comment is that so the lambda Casimir of this representation is obviously just given here. So the different values of lambda you take here are going to label the different representations that you have. But then remember that we also had another Casimir, which is still present, while it's a bit modified by this central extension, but we still have another Casimir. And it turns out that in this representation, this Casimir vanishes. So what that means is that we are working in a set of representations where that are defined by different values of lambda, which is just a label of the representation, but also we only are dealing with representation in which this other Casimir vanishes. So maybe you could think of as just dealing with massive spinless particle in the Poincaré case. So this is not complete, but this is okay. Kind of what we were able to work with.
One question. This might be completely off place. In the W infinity story, there's a kind of sense in which you get a W infinity algebra from like mu, the two components of mu and powers of them turn into like the generator. So the first part of the tower is like two guys and then it's quadratic, et cetera. So is there any chance that you could find that type of symmetry in the structure or is that off place? I don't think it's off place, right? Like there's two components of mu and it's like diffeomorphisms of the plane. Build a W infinity from like a tower of like say cubic terms for the next one and then quadratic. I think of a and a dagger as like mu zero, mu one, like on the twister space because it's a diffeomorphism in the two plane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
But yeah.
There might be something interesting as you move to the enveloping algebra of this algebra. Yes.
Okay, sorry.
But here we're at this level. Any cubic or quartic will be represented as a function of these operators, right? But it sounds very reasonable what you're saying. So it would be double W1 plus infinity, like two wedges, because here, W1 plus infinity, you can see it is generated from DMS as you keep going. And here there are two copies of DMS.
I want to say like A is like mu zero and A dagger is mu one or something like that. For the fact that,
because of the translation.
Maybe.
That's a good answer.
So lambda is labeling the representation, you said?
Yes. So lambda is.
So this is a continuous variable.
Yes.
So do we have an infinite set of irreducible representations?
So we have an infinite family of irreducible representations, yes, labeled by this parameter that comes from the central extension.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And the Casimir would be like the zero guy, and the W infinity would be the corner of the wedge that's like.
Yeah.
Okay,
one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, great. So this is our Hilbert space. And now what do we want to do with it? What we want to do with this Hilbert space is we want to deal with how do you glue two subsystems together. So let me give you kind of a motivation of why we want to do that and why it's not trivial in the case of gauge theories. Think of this picture. So you have kind of those two parts here, the left and the right spatial slice. And since we're in 1+1 dimension, this is actually an accurate drawing. And they are separated by this corner prong that is kind of the entangling surface of the problem. But you just have those two subsystems, right? And what happens in quantum theory is that the Hilbert space of the whole system is going to simply be given by the tensor product of the left and right subsystem. And then obviously you can then do entanglement entropy things with that. But in gauge theory, it's actually kind of a complication that arises from the fact that you have gauge constraints that both data on both slices need to obey those constraints. And so what that means is that those data cannot be given completely independently. And at the end of the story, what that means is that this glued Hilbert space, the Hilbert space of the whole thing, is going to be a sub Hilbert space of the tensor product, where you also you impose the gauge constraints on these glued states, these tensor product states. Now, as we know, the gauge constraint can be expressed by the vanishing of the charge. That's what we've been saying at the beginning. The gauge constraint, so gauge invariance, is expressed by the fact that the charge associated to this gauge symmetry vanishes. This is also what you do, I think, when you do the Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity, if you do everything in this 3 plus 1 decomposition. You have this constraint that's expressed by the fact that the charge vanishes. And now if we will, what we have here is that we will have charges, corner charges associated with this left part on this left, so taken as the corner, which is the boundary of this left part, and also the right charges. So the fact that the charges vanishes across the line is the same as saying that the left and right charges must be the same. So that's going to be our gluing condition, because since the surface has a different orientation, if they are the same, then the entire charge just vanishes. So that's the constraint we're going to take. So let me give you an idea of the setup here. So we have these two subregions that have a corner, and then we want to glue those two subregions together. So what we will have is we start with a left copy of the algebra on the left, and a right copy on the right. And now also remember we had this Fock space as our Hilbert space. Now we're going to work in the coherent state basis. So those the eigenvectors of the annihilation operator, and because this is going to be convenient for just the next slide. So we have one Hilbert space on the left, one Hilbert space on the right, algebra on the left, algebra on the right. And also something that I will do that might seem a bit strange, but actually it's not that much, is that on the right side here, I will take those states to be eigenvectors of the right annihilation operator, but with an eigenvalue of the complex conjugates of gamma here, which might seem weird, but actually is something that is done, for example, in thermal field theory, which is something I'm going to talk, just give a few words about later. So for now, let's just go with that. We have left, right, all of the setup is here. So now we want to say left and right charges coincide. But in the quantum theory, what do we mean by charges coinciding is actually not that trivial, because for example, you could ask for the operators to be the same at the operator level, but this is a very strong condition that is, for example, in this case, going to vanish everything, so that's not interesting. So what we're going to do is that we're going to define the value of the charge, as we usually do in quantum theory, as the eigenvalues of the operators. But then what that means is that we can only ask for the maximal commuting subalgebra of this algebra to be equal on the left and on the right, because you can't, right, you define the value as the eigenvector, so you can't diagonalize all of the algebra simultaneously. So you can only take the maximal amount of operators that commute, diagonalize them, this is why we're working in coherent states here, and then ask for these to be equal on the right and on the left. So first thing you do is you form just the product space, and this is the glued space with the tilde, because we haven't imposed the gauge constraint yet. And the gauge constraints are going to be imposed, as we've been saying, that way. So we just say that the left and the right, we choose here lambda L minus P minus, those three operators that commute. Three is the maximum number of commuting operators. And we're going to say we want the action of these operators from the left acting on these kind of states to be equal to the ones on the right. And what this is going to do, this first one is just going to kind of trivially say that the representation on the left and the representation on the right must be the same, right? So the value of lambda that labels the representation is going to be the same on the right and on the left. And then those two other ones are going to, if you remember, L minus and P minus are expressed in terms of annihilation operators. That's why we work in coherent basis here. And what those are going to do is just say that you have the same value of alpha on the left, and then alpha conjugate on the right, because we choose this kind of conjugate algebra on the right.
Sorry, maybe dumb question is, if you're in the same representation and you also have the same values of, like, the diagonal subgroup, like, don't all the rest of the, like, states become the same because you generate them with the symmetry all action on both sides, or no?
No, because the So the representation are only labeled by this lambda parameter. So the different representation just mean different value of lambda.
Sure.
But then the states inside this representation can be any states, right? Any like linear combination.
I thought that I could, if I basically can generate the rest of the states by acting with the symmetry algebra on the generators that are mutually commuting, then they would be the same.
So that those mutually commuting operators, you can't generate the whole state with them, right?
With the other ones, right? I think what I'm saying is if I could write any other, is it maybe I'm being dumb about group theory, like if I can write any other group element as like something outside of that commuted with these guys, like I thought that I'm basically aligning the, like, if I can get to any other state by acting with the symmetry generator that exists on both the left and the right, then I can see why they're not this.
What are others?
The group element labels the degrees of freedom.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's how you encode the computation.
Yeah. So you cannot act only with the right algebra and generate everything inside the HT logic.
Yeah.
Yeah, the product space.
Same for the left.
Right, because the right is only going to like move if you take the n m is only going to move this part of the Hilbert space, and the left only this part, right?
Oh, sure. I think I was just saying that I thought as soon as I lay my maximal commuting subalgebra and I'm the same representation, that's like any other state
yes,
would be.
If you do that equality, yes.
Yeah.
So that's what happens here, right? So we have then that the glute states are going to be expressed in this form. So the final glute hybrid space where we took those gauge constraints into account is this, have this form here. Okay, so first thing I want to mention is that there is, obviously you can see that from this, since these are all just, those states are just labeled by the value of alpha, there is a correspondence between the glute state and only the left state and only the right state, which is going to be important just on the next slide where I'm going to talk about then how do you glue and separate things, so that this is actually a very good thing. And then The last element that we need is that on those glute states, we want to have the same algebra acting in the same way on the glute state as the left algebra acts on the left state and the right algebra acts on the right state. And it turns out you can construct this glute algebra that acts in the way that we want from the left and the right operators, and you can only do that. It looks like you can only do that, but this is still something I need to discuss with Luca, for example. Because here you have this kind of conjugate value of alpha. So from the left and right, you can construct the glute algebra as well, so that we kind of successfully fused those two subsystems together. And I'm going to just give you like this image of what's happening. So we're going to go in the other way now, but you can start with this line without any corners. Since there's no corners, there's no boundary, there's no states that describe this line for now, but then you just take this line and then you can say, I want to separate this line into two subsystems by placing this corner here, and then to this corner you will have an associated set of states, so the Hilbert space associated to this segment with this corner is going to be given by one alpha here, and then what we've been doing before means that we know how to take this alpha and just kind of double it, right, in this way, by saying I will take alpha on the left and then this alpha prime star on the right, and then this will describe my two segments, right? So I double this alpha, then I have the left and the right one that define the left subsystem and the right subsystem. So this is how you separate this line into two subsystems, and then if you do the opposite direction, starting with a general here, gamma, is what we've been doing before, right? So you start with gamma alpha, and then you, to go the other way, just do what we've been doing. So now we know how to separate or glue subsystem together. Okay, so that's kind of the story. And now let me just make a quick comment on entanglement entropy, but I'm going to kind of just give you a first draft of an idea of how you could get entanglement entropy from this gluing procedure. But this is going to be quite hand-waving, but let me just, it's just kind of an...
I'm sorry, I lost the track of lambda. So where is lambda playing a role here, except that you have to choose a lambda?
Lambda is So, yeah, lambda is going to be here.
Yeah, but that's just a choice.
So this is the way the annihilation operator acts on alpha, right?
Yeah.
But the operator we have is not only this, is the translation. P minus is the annihilation operator, and in front of the P minus, there's a lambda here. So this is where it is. When you act with the translation P minus on a coherent state, you get the eigenvalue lambda times the complex number alpha.
Okay.
This is where lambda is. Okay, so this is the story I wanted to tell you now. I'm just going to give you kind of an intuition of how we could try to think of entanglement entropy in this case. And one of the way we could try to go at it is that it turns out that this kind of doubling of the space of the state alpha, so taking a copy of the Hilbert space, copying it on the right and having kind of this conjugate version of it with a star, is actually exactly what the framework of this Thermofield theory thing that people from quantum optics basically came up with to define quantum field theory at finite temperature from the zero temperature one. So this is exactly what happens there. So that's just kind of a clue of maybe we can do something interesting with that. And this is also only true because we have, again, this star here. So this is another reason why we like to have this star on the right. So for example, one thing you can do is that you can consider these states here. So you can act on the glued state, right? This glued state here. You act on it with this operator here, right? Where theta is just given by this function. This is also where lambda appears, because in the standard story of Thermofield theory, where they work with bosonic operator because they want to work with photon, basically, here they have the omega of the oscillator. But in our case, we identify the scale of the oscillator with this lambda, right? The only energy scale we have is this lambda. So this is, we kind of identify this lambda with the omega of the usual bosonic oscillator thing. So this is also where it appears. And it's really important that we have a scale here, right? Because otherwise we couldn't consider this function. So that's kind of the importance of this central extension here. So again, very hand-waving, but consider this state, which is kind of a thermalized, coherent, glued state, double. Consider this state. It turns out that in Thermofield theory, you can show that these states, so this operator acting on the glued states, is equivalent to a state only on the left side, so the non-doubled version of the problem, that is defined by this density matrix here. So from Thermofield theory, this is just a reference where they talk about this kind of stuff here at the bottom. And from this Thermofield theory, the state we saw before is equivalent to only one state on the left that is defined by this density matrix, so this thermal state here. And then you can say, okay, let's compute the entanglement entropy associated to this density matrix. And the easiest way I found to do it here is to use the replica trick, because just you're going to compute powers, the density matrix, and when you compute powers, this is the displacement operator, which is kind of a standard in coherent space. So when you compute powers, you can see that these will cancel, so that's very convenient. So if you just use this replica trick to calculate the associated entanglement entropy to this density matrix here, this formula, and then you look at what happens at high temperatures, so at low values of beta, you find this behavior, which is interesting because it's actually kind of what we would expect, because you have this first term here that corresponds, is kind of the equivalent in 1 plus 1 dimension of the Bekenstein-Hawking term, because the Bekenstein-Hawking term is going to be proportional to the area, but here we don't have any area because it's just a corner, so we have kind of this constant here, constant term. And then the second term looks exactly like the expected quantum corrections to this Bekenstein-Hawking area law in gravity. So, for example, something I can say is that if you do some entanglement entropy consideration in Jacques-Yves Teitelbohm gravity, for example, you're going to get also exactly this form here with this UV divergence here in the quantum corrections. So this is just kind of a draft of how we could start thinking about these kind of ideas and see that we could get results have the expected form here.
So when you say it's an expected UV divergence, is lambda now a UV
Konov? No UV in the sense that, that when beta goes to zero, the temperature goes high, this temp diverges. That, I didn't mean anything else by that.
Okay.
But in the, yeah, in so for example, in Jacques-Yves Tati bone gravity, this, this lambda is actually the cosmological constant U phi. And it kind of acts like a, this cutoff, yes. Right, so that is, that's what I wanted to talk about. So just to recap quickly, we found a family of Hilbert space of quantum gravity from only from the corner symmetry groups. No assay family because we only, the way we constructed them, we only had vanishing Casimir, right? The second cubic Casimir was vanishing this presentation. So we only work in this kind of a subset of all of the possible representations. So it's not complete. Then we gave this prescription to glue or separate two spatial subregions together with gluing procedure that I explained. Here there should be a star. And then we kind of gave an idea of how we could start asking questions about this entanglement entropy, maybe using this very similar structure that we have to this thermofield theories and all of that. So that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, so until now you haven't said anything about how you choose these spatial subregions. So this is now completely arbitrary.
Yes, yes, for now.
So whatever, you know, I can assign these properties. There's nothing special happening in terms of physics.
No, this is
any point is as good as any other.
Yeah, because you, this is basically the idea is that you choose. So this boundary is not something physical. It's not like we only consider, for example, universes that have a boundary at a finite distance. It's just that you, when you consider subsystems, you have to choose, okay, this is going to be my subsystem, and then the subsystem is going to have kind of this fixtures boundary here. So that's kind of the idea of what happened here.
Okay, even I think of more, maybe higher dimensional, more like gravity systems, right? So I'm just wondering to what extent then these corner algebras know about the interiors of these regions.
Right, so...
Say about that topology.
Yeah, so that is a great question and very interesting one is well, this is kind of the idea of the corner proposal, but this is also why it's a proposal, is that the idea is that we think or we hope that we can give the entire gravity story, so also the entire manifold topology geometry in the bulk from only this data at the on the boundary at the corner, but this is a holographic idea that is not completely clear yet, if I'm not mistaken, but maybe Luca, you can comment on that, if this is true or not. But in two dimensions, it's kind of obvious that it is, because there's no, the only degrees of freedom in the theory are the edge modes that live on the boundary, right? Because in gravity, in two-dimensional gravity, you don't have any degree of freedom in the bulk. So to gravity, this is kind of trivial, but then in higher dimensions, it's not clear that you can actually describe entirely gravity from only this corner data, that's for sure. So that's the hope of the proposal.
So, maybe two questions. First, you didn't give the geometrical interpretation of the second Casimir, right? You generate it as in terms of the metric, and then the meaning that it's null.
So, no, I don't expect, especially in this extended centrally extended version, because this centrally extended version of the Casimir, I've not seen in any other work. So this is. It's not completely clear to us what it means geometrically.
Well, it's a semi-classical version. You know what the second Casimir is?
No, not this extended one. I know that the...
No, semi-classically, when you don't have central extension.
So this...
You can write these charges in terms of the metric components.
Yes, and the Casimir of the... I know the SL2R Casimir is understood as the area of the corner. I'm not mistaken. The complete Casimir with also the translations included. We don't yet know the geometric interpretation of that. So it also
here your points have zero area.
Yeah. Yes. Also something I should mention that's interesting about this Casimir is that in all of the representations that we have of this algebra, this Casimir actually vanishes. So it's kind of hard to understand what this Casimir is, because in the fundamental, like the vector field representation on like two-dimensional space-time, it vanishes. And in all of, in a lot of different representations that you can use for this corner algebra with the translation, this Casimir vanishes. So it is tricky to understand what this Casimir is geometrically. That is also definitely something we want to understand better, yeah.
So now you mentioned JT gravity, where people have already, so there, in some sense, in JT, there's a UV complete description, right?
Yes.
And so can you compare with what people know there? And what I mean there is that, a physical description means that you have a unique, so in JT gravity, there's a unique spectra of what this representation should be. So can you just mm-hmm. write down what is the Planck-Schrödinger measure that the fully, non-perturbative JT in gravity is?
No, not yet. It's because this is also early stage, and as we don't even have all of the representations, for example, so.
Well, you know the labels, so forget about how you represent them. We can, so now you have a label. The question is the planche, the measure,
mm-hmm.
which, how do you choose the distribution of weights?
Right.
You have an answer for that.
Yes, it's defined. Here I have to say that it's not something that for this particular project we've been thinking about yet, so I don't know the answer to that, if this is something that's completely defined also in this corner proposal business in two dimensions. I don't know.
Maybe I have a question. So the SL that you were showing before, this is also thermal, right? That's another thing that you didn't comment about, but it also gives a nice description of the fact that you are tracing out the degrees of freedom to the right, and therefore it becomes thermal, right?
Yeah, so this bipartite representation.
Yes.
You mean. Yeah, so this is something you can do for sure. You can also represent this with in this bipartite formalism, and actually, if you don't consider the central extension, you need to use this bipartite representation to represent the algebra. But here, the simplest way of representing this centrally extended one is actually not using this bipartite. So that's like the first thing that we kind of think about. But they are also, and even more than that, you can represent this algebra with an arbitrary number of oscillators. Actually, this like bipartite one, so when you have two types of oscillator, is one, but you can also represent them with a three or four of any number of them, which is this whole metaplectic representation business that I've not gone into. So and maybe also this will give different representations with where the Casimir doesn't vanish, for example. That's something that we have to look into. But there are obviously a lot of different ways to represent them with a lot of different number of operators. That's also something interesting for sure.
Thanks. Lauren?
Maybe it's more of a remark. We can chat about it. But you have a quotient orbit, so can mm-hmm. easily construct the quotient orbit of this group.
Yep.
In fact, for the infinite dimensional group, we know also how to construct them, right?
Yeah.
And then in that case, you do have a geometrical interpretation. So you have a classification mm-hmm. and a geometrical interpretation of what they are.
Of the Casimir, the quadrant orbits.
So the one thing I can say about the C3 Casimir is that it kind of looks like the Pauli Lubansky, but for SL2R semidirector R2, mm-hmm. kind of has the same flavor, because as an epsilon, there's an antisymmetrization P dot J. And another thing that is kind of interesting, but I never really understood the physics behind, because we didn't find yet a representation of the G. If you go to the universal corner, if you add this G, L, the singlet inside GL, this ceases to be a Casimir and is actually conjugate to that singlet generator. Mm. It's kind of an interesting feature, which is it's kind of a conformal object, so it resonates with what we were saying, that it's kind of the area for this group. Mm-hmm. But we never found a dynamical theory for which the singlet was turned on. So. Other questions? Okay, so let's thank Ludovic again.